Hello, and welcome to another CG Garage, episode number 13. Lucky number 13! Brought to you by Chaos Group. Sorry about last week, guys. Couldn't get the podcast out. It was just a lot of stuff going on, and then we had some technical issues, and anyway, didn't happen. But this week, we really, hopefully, brought it back in spades because it features Lou Pecora, a really, really great friend of mine, and a really amazing person. I've known Lou for years, which you'll quickly figure out when you hear the podcast. He's a VFX supervisor over at Digital Domain. And one of my favorite memories of Lou recently is when I remember very quickly, when I woke up in the morning and I saw my news on my phone and I saw the people who were nominated for an Oscar. And I know several other people on that list and they're all really great guys, but Lou's name popped up for Days of Future Past, for X-Men Days of Future Past, and I was so happy for him. He's such a great guy, and really having him there made a big difference for me. So I was very excited. Texted him first thing in the morning. Anyway, you listen to podcasts. I hope you'll enjoy it as much as I do. Remember to leave your comments. I know comment section was broken for a bit, but if you want to leave your comments on this podcast, please do. You can also send us a note on Twitter. Our Twitter account is @CG_labs, so @CG_labs. And besides that, I haven't mentioned Gina in this podcast, so I'm going to mention her now just to make sure I got that out of the way. And that's it. Hopefully you enjoy it, guys. Thank you.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
So good to see you, Chris.
Oh, I love you, brother.
Love you too.
Good to see you, man. You're going to have to disclose that we're buds.
That is going to be true. Have you heard the podcast before?
I did. I heard the one you did with Preek.
Okay.
About Los Alamos and all of that.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. I didn't know all that about Preek either.
Yeah. You do a perfect Preek guest. The thing of... hold on. Can you talk into the microphone? Or hold on.
Why, certainly.
Is that an end fire microphone?
Oh my goodness. I'm going to have to talk into it.
Why are you talking so deep?
What are you talking about? This is my normal voice. All right. Yeah. Here we go. Is that good? Is that how levels
are? Yeah, you
okay?
Sound great.
Am I loud?
You are.
How about now?
Well, now you're echoing. Because you're so loud. So you did listen to the one with Preek, right?
I did. I didn't listen to the whole thing. I listened to bits and pieces of that one, and I tried to listen to the ICT one, and I couldn't. It didn't. For some reason, my machine kept choking. I wanted to hear Jay. I was like, oh, Jay.
Yeah, you know Jay.
I know Jay.
Yeah, and Graham. Graham is hilarious. So
yep, I know Jay better than Graham, but both really, really cool. Great people out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I was actually just there now. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We're working on a project called the WikiHuman Project.
The which?
The WikiHuman Project.
WikiHuman.
We're making a sort of open source human project.
Open source human project?
Steve Preek is part of it, actually.
It's a Digital Human League, right?
Yeah. We first worked together on iRobot.
But
I think we actually sort of... Did you do anything on Day After Tomorrow?
I was not. I was on Looney Tunes at the time.
You were on Looney Tunes, that's right.
Appropriately named Looney Tunes.
And I remember the room that was done for Looney Tunes, and someone put a Looney bin on the door. There was a sign.
Oh, yeah, the Looney Bin. Yeah, that was our review room. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. And it was right next to the screening room. Was that room right next to the screening room?
Yep. That was where like Gamache and those guys were sitting.
Yeah. And so you were on that show.
I was on that show. John Carner, all the crazies. That's why it was called the Looney Bin, mostly because of him, I think.
Yeah, probably. Probably. I remember that. But then you and I started working. There was my first job as a lead. So it was my first lead job. I'd never been anything in that on iRobot. And you and I got partnered together on a couple of sequences. You were the 2D lead and I was the lighting lead, right?
On the HQ sequence?
The HQ sequence.
Yeah. And HQ 5000.
Yeah. So we can talk about HQ 5000 because it's a hilarious, hilarious story. But so it was my first experience with you doing that. And it was pretty cool. I learned a lot from you in that time because I didn't really know about being a lead. I was just panicking most of the time.
See, that part I had down. I learned a lot about how much I didn't know about the CG aspect of things from you on that okay. show. You know, so I actually, you know, our lighting department at the time was, we had basically, at that time, it was comp and everything else.
Right.
And so we, you know, lighting becoming more of a discipline that was looked at as its own in-depth department, kind of, I remember it really getting going around then where people were like, you know.
They were taking it seriously as a separate department.
As a separate discipline that was, yeah, you know, brought up.
Right.
You know, as its own thing. And it was really interesting because there was a lot, you know, my background is in comp. And before that, my background is in, you know, I didn't go to school for this job. So I had to learn it all on the job. So learning from guys like you and from like Andy Waisler, you know, like,
yeah,
because he was on the VL portion of that.
That's right.
A ton from him too. And
yep,
it was good. I mean, a lot of great people to learn from around that time, Paul George, you know, when the lighters, proper lighters were there and being
right.
given like a good say in how stuff should look. That was great. Cause I get to learn a lot about how all that stuff went together.
And we did something pretty interesting at that time, which was the first time we sort of broke out shaders and put them back together again in comp.
That's right. So the MakeBot.
Right. So it was kind of a new thing where we would basically take the shader and we would reassemble it in comp and tweak it there. And we had these special gizmos that we made to get all the translucencies of those robots and all that working. Cause that was before ray tracing. We had to sort of fake all that translucency.
Yeah, out of RenderMan, taking all the passes of the, you know, the using Fresnel. And I didn't know what Fresnel was at that point. I think I learned that from you, actually.
Shocker.
And that was great, though. Mark Rienzo, I remember putting that gizmo together with the Estrus, I want to say. Or no, was it Estrus or was it?
Well, Estrus and Paul George were involved, and
Eggstat was definitely involved with the train because he had that bottle on his desk, the plastic bottle, and he was always looking at how light would refract through the edges.
Right.
And like if I think it was if Apple made an Android, what would it be like? And you have to capture all the realistic properties. So those old semi-translucent Mac shells were somewhat influential in how that would look.
Very much so. Who was the designer on that Rosen? Was it Tatopoulos?
Patrick Tatopoulos.
Tatopoulos, yeah. Right.
I think Dan Platt. Actually, I think
Dan Platt was involved.
I believe, he told me this himself. And afterwards, I've gone back and looked at Sonny. And the Sonny face is based on a cast that Dan Platt did of his own face. And if you go back and look at Sonny and then look at Dan, you're like, geez, you could see it.
Yeah.
You could totally see it. It's funny. And that was when Dan was working with Patrick Tatopoulos on the design.
Just so people know on the podcast, we're talking about someone named Dan Platt. And Dan Platt was one of our lead character people.
Brilliant guy.
At DD and Modeler. And he worked practically for a long time. So he did maquettes and a bunch of things. As an example, Dan Platt he worked on buttons and all the character shapes on buttons and Clue and a lot of that stuff.
I worked with him on G.I. Joe too.
Yeah.
Does Zartan.
Really, really brilliant guy. By the way, he has forgotten more about anatomy than I will ever know. I mean, he knows absolutely every muscle in the human body and how it all works.
It's funny you say that because I remember when we were talking about a bid that we did for that, like, you know, Dan, how long do you think it'll take? Because you're booked on one show. We need to borrow you to do this head. How long do you think it'll take? And he told us how many weeks it was. And I was just like, really? That many weeks? And his answer was, do you want all the pores to be in the right place on that skin or not? Well, that's a little granular. No, we don't want them all in the right place. We just need to make it look like a reasonable facsimile of this person.
And, right. And like,
fine. he was great. He's a perfectionist and he's really, really good. I mean, you don't bring him in if you want to hack something, that's for sure.
Yeah, no. I remember like I was doing a character on a Halo spot and we were trying to figure out why her proportions on her body weren't quite looking right. And he started saying, well, you know, this muscle's not connected to this muscle. So you see that hip bone, it should be about, you know, half an inch higher. And it was just like, well, it probably makes sense. We just did a few adjustments and a half hour conversation with him saved us weeks of trying to noodle something into space. So
yeah.
Really, really bright guy. Anyway,
messing
as you
around
said,
with the rig when it's the model that's not quite right, and he knows it. Yeah, exactly.
So you're saying that basically, Sonny, the main robot, his face you think is that face is a cast of his face?
I think it's based on a cast of Dan's face. Huh. I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, but I believe that is what it is. And yeah. When I looked at it, because Asuka has the statue,
right?
The maquette at her desk, and I look at it, and I was like, God, that does look like Dan. Oh my God, I'm looking at the two of them.
Yeah,
it's funny.
Yeah. That's pretty funny.
I did not murder him.
So one of the things I remember about that show specifically was when we were doing lighting, it was Eric Nash, who was our VFX supervisor. So I should also note that I've known Lou for years, he also tends to, you may not bring up someone's name, he will imitate that person's voice instantaneously, including mine. See, he just imitated my laugh, which I don't even hear my laugh, except now when I listen to my podcast, it's like, oh, I can hear Lou mocking my diving board laugh.
Not mocking, appreciating.
There it is. So anyway, Lou... Eric Nash was practical. He came from miniatures,
motion
right?
control, yeah.
Motion control, yep. Miniatures, stuff yep, of yep. that nature. And he was a DP on miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to learn, because we had this new lighting department, as you were mentioning, or in that way, he wanted to learn how we light the robot so he could make comments on how he thinks we need to make adjustments, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I volunteered to sit down with Eric and show him how to light a robot in Maya. And the first reaction to him, this was back in the RenderMan days when there was, you had to light things a certain way. There was no GI, there was no real area lights, there's nothing like mm-hmm. that. And I said, all right. He says, why do you have 27 lights in your scene? And he just could not understand it. And I was like, yeah, it's a little, I know it seems excessive, but this is the way you have to do it in order to, you have a light to imitate the bounce of the light. And so all of those things were done in there. And it was convincing, and he got it. And he totally, I remember his.
There's no radiosity. You're just putting another light in there.
You're just putting another light in there to imitate.
Dimmer.
So
yeah.
you had to figure out on your own where you thought what the color of the light bouncing off of it would be and all of that stuff.
Yeah, so whippersnappers have it easy now with all this
fancy GI
and business.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nerd.
You know what my argument is now is I had this another podcast. I said you a lighter should be able to light a shot as fast as a DP lights a shot. So it shouldn't take you 2 weeks to light a shot. A DP takes about 10 minutes to light a shot or he's fired, right? So you got to be able but you got to be able to do that because there's no excuse for it anymore. You have the same technology, let's just put it that way, in terms of ray tracing to make it happen. You just have to have a fast enough ray tracer to do it.
Sure. My argument is always with that is that like I go back and forth on that whole thing because one of the things I really miss is that sense of personality that individual lighters will put into things. And I always argue that when you're on set and like, well, a giant robot goes here. I'm like, okay, great. The giant robot goes there. So, well, we've captured the HDR. We've run our science and it says that all the lights are represented here. So that's what it should look like. I don't care if it's super dark in these areas. And you think like, well, if there really was a big robot on that stage, you would add a light here, a kicker there, a mirror board here. And so that's where I, with the pure science and academia of it, I always struggle because I feel like there's so much more room for the, well, I would want to see inside that robot's chest cavity. So I'm going to put a robot here.
I absolutely agree with you. I'm not certainly dismissing this. Like you just do light to the HDR and you're done. That's certainly not the case. But I think that the amount of time that it takes to light something, you should know. You should be able to just move the light around. It's like, that's where I want that highlight and done. And you shouldn't have 27 lights. You should have one light or two lights or whatever a DP would do logically on set. You should do the same thing.
Exactly. And you're still putting other lights in where a kicker would be.
Yeah, because
or a mirror,
guess what? The reason we have a CG robot is because there is no CG robot there.
There's
no real robot, so they don't know how it's really supposed to look like.
Exactly. And so you can't rely completely on everything that's gathered on set. And
no.
Preservation of every photon. I mean, that's fine if you're doing an academic paper on it, but you're trying to put out a piece of art, something that's going to end up on the screen that has to evoke a certain emotion in the audience and make the filmmaker feel like they got what they wanted. They got the performance they wanted. And the performance that you're doing in lighting and in Maya and ultimately in the comp is no different than the performance they're getting on set from an actor or an actress. You know, I don't like the way your skin's a little too shiny here. Let's get, okay, makeup comes out and puts a little pat on it.
Right.
It might be, well, that's their skin and that's the light and there you go. No one's going to tell them that on set. So why should anyone tell them or me or you that in post when you're working on something? It's like, if it looks the way you want it to look, then it's right. I don't care if there's 27 or 270 lights or one light. It just, it's all what you're artistically going for. And I think these days, I feel like when you sit there at the Bake Off or when you sit there in SIGGRAPH, it feels like it's so much about like, well, we can render all this in one pass, or we can render all these different hairs, or we can, you know, this deep compositing. Like in deep compositing, you have one character in the background. What do you need deep for that? I mean, just because it's a tool that's there that you can use doesn't mean you have to use it on every shot. Doesn't mean you have to use everything, you know, to the max technically. I mean, I feel like a lot of times we get mired in the technology, and some people are still wowed by it so much so that it becomes more the focus rather than what the pixels that actually end up on screen.
They'd rather use the technology than actually create the art.
Almost for the sake of using the technology, dare I say. I'm not going to name names.
Right.
But we have all seen it. And it just, and you feel it too. You look at it and you say, you know, it doesn't have a soul. I mean, that sounds, might sound ridiculous, but I like something that might be technically wrong. And fine, great. That's what we're going to go with.
Yes. I'm actually, there's a podcast I recorded today actually with a group of us, and it's just us in the office. Actually, Daniel Buck, you know Daniel, of course.
Oh yeah.
And David Tracy, I don't know if you know David and Lon Gross, but the name of the podcast is It's All Just Done on Computers These Days. And the podcast is about the fact that there's a lot of people that goes like, I don't really like CG. It was so much better in the old days. And it's always this argument about why CG is bad. Mm-hmm. And my argument is not that CG is bad, is that we keep asking to do the same stuff over and over again. There's really good CG out there. And what's bad is bad CG.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same as you know, rear projection. You know, at the time it was all the rave back in the day, and you'd see it in every movie for no good reason. You'd see two people driving and you'd just see the road behind them. You don't need that. You could have done, you know, back and forth with the actor and in the driver's seat and the actor in the passenger seat and go back and forth and done titers on him or something. There's a lot of different ways they could have done that. But because, oh, look, this is, here we go. Let's show it off. Mm-hmm. That's all you see, you know?
Yeah.
I think people are still, I think just now we're starting to come out of that where filmmakers are realizing that, you know, the older school guys are understanding it enough to where they know how to not use it. And when to use it, when not to use it.
Right.
And the newer generation totally knows it and gets it. And they're more interested in getting through their film rather than getting wowed by or put off by the technology. It just becomes another tool in the filmmaker's kit. You know, remember when Avid first came out and all those wipes? I was just watching Briscoe County Jr. the other day. You know,
okay.
Old school show. It was a great, great show, you know, really ahead of its time in a lot of ways. But my God, those wipes. It's like for the first time they were able to do these, you know, literally star wipes and pinwheel wipes and side to side wipes. And I was like, wow, they were loving this new toy that they had.
And they're just going to use it no matter what.
Using it. And we've been guilty of that. We're as guilty of that as anybody, you know, ourselves. But just trying to recognize that trap and stay out of it, you know, is important. It's an important
make it,
step.
Make it have a reason.
Make it serve the story rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
That's something I've been, I was lucky in the last couple of films I got to work on that it was, you know, there was artistic components to it that were so, the technology couldn't help us. There was no technology out in there. It had to be like, it was a very designy thing. And you're like, what are you going to do? I don't know. And that's where we got to really have some fun and experiment and come up with all the wrong stuff. And it felt great.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. So how long have you been at DDNA?
Oh my God. July 9th of 1998. What is that?
17 years?
Yeah, almost 17 years.
What were you doing before that?
I was at Digital Magic before that. I was there for about a year and a half. I was doing, at the time, I was the only artistic contribution I got to make really was Morphs. I was doing the Morphs on a show that at the time people didn't have any idea what it would turn into. So it was really easy for me to do it. It was Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
People
got a hold of that and they were like, I don't know, let someone else do this. And I was just, are you kidding me? I get to morph people into vampires and back. I'm in, you know, it's awesome. Ever since I saw American Werewolf in London, I've been fascinated with the idea of these kind of transitions and how you do them. Of course, you know, it was definitely different than the way Rick and those guys did it in that movie. But it was like a dream come true for me to get to do that. So I was working on that, and then they were going through a period of like mergers with POP and some other stuff going on, and they didn't really know how my position was going to, because at the time I was technically, my job was like data transfer or something. I was like a data tech guy.
God, yeah.
That's what I got hired for in the first place, year and a half prior to that. And so they didn't really know what they were going to do with me, where I was going to go, but I'd picked up enough Elastic Reality where I met Christine Lowe, and she was doing the morphs here, and she didn't want to do the morphs anymore. So she was like, hey, here's a guy who's happy to do them, and look, he knows what he's doing. And she took my reel and showed it to anybody who would listen. And anybody that tried to get her to do a morph, she would just show them my reel. You should call this guy. And, wow. And they gave me an interview.
So here, you're Mr. Grid Warp.
Not anymore. Elastic Reality was awesome, though. I love that package.
I remember. The only problem I had with it is that it was too linear. It didn't have a good ease that you could put onto your transitions. Or maybe I'm wrong.
No, it did.
It did?
Yeah, it did. For sure it did. Okay. You could weight the curves. It was more like the way you would deal with them. It was more like almost like a gamma curve for time, though.
If that makes any sense. Okay.
It wasn't like a Bezier where you could completely have full control over it. You had sort of a weight that you could put to the curve.
Gotcha. Okay.
But and the dissolve as well. The dissolve and the shape you can weight independently, which I thought was pretty useful as well. Mike Canfer hired me over here basically to do roto and morphs. And 3 months later, Brian Grill had me comping shots and
what were you working on?
It was Supernova.
That was my first
film at DD. Yeah. Walter Hill. And that was awesome. I mean, I was comping a space city. It was a floating space city. And Mark Stetson was the VFX soup on that.
Nice.
And I had found out, you know, he was the model shop guy on Blade Runner. I mean,
talk
about futuristic city.
Yeah, I met him. He's at Zoic now.
Yep. Oh, yeah. I still keep in good touch with Mark.
Yeah.
He was the guy, the futuristic space city guy.
Yeah.
And I remember it was like 3 a.m. and he saw my shot for the last time. He said, he's like, well, I think that's one of the best damn floating space cities I've ever seen. And I just was, I felt like I was just over the moon. Like, Mark Stetson likes my goddamn space city. This is fantastic. You know, I was so happy. That's still one of my favorite
moments.
That's
like Michael Jordan saying that was one of the best jump stops that's ever seen.
I guess, yeah. For like basketball. Yeah, that was...
it's funny. I actually don't watch sports at all. So yeah, I don't know why.
But I think I know who you're talking about, though. He's on the shoes, right?
His silhouette is. Right? all right. So Supernova.
Supernova.
And then what were some other notable shows that you liked, that you worked on?
Well, actually, let me give you a quick backup on the Supernova thing. Mark Stetson, one of the things that taught me I was in the big leagues here at DD was, it was really late at night. Maybe it was like 2 a.m. that same night. And Mark has me in the review room, and he's looking at it. He says, all right, I think we need a little more atmosphere over here, a little, make this twinkle, you know, 50% less. And that light needs to be, you know, 5% brighter, this one guide light, 5% brighter. And I said, okay, got it. Went back to my desk, and, you know, you're half asleep, tired, you know, making all the changes, trying to get it out of there. You got coordinators, you know, do you need anything? Do you need any coffee? You get, you know, I just need to finish this. You know, you get it done, shoot it. And it pops up again, and I go in there, and Stetson looks at it, and he goes, did you make that light 5% brighter? First thing he says. And I said, yeah. All right, that's it. I'm calling BS on that. I want to see. Let's go check it out at your desk. I'm like, darn it. And I'm walking back to my desk, and did I do it? Did I not do it? I don't remember. We get back there, and we AB the two of them, and he goes, aha, everybody gets one on a show. That was yours. Too bad it was so early in the show. I was like, wow, 5% brighter. I am so out of my league here. This is ridiculous. You know, I was... It was very awesome, intimidating, and it was a call to a challenge. You know, it was the gauntlet had been thrown down. Like, can you handle this? Like, all right, I'm going to definitely handle this. But this is a whole different level than I was used to. You know,
I think you did that to me a couple of times.
I think I did. If not, I wanted to.
Yeah. I remember actually very specifically something had happened that didn't go well.
And that never happens.
No. And I was on, it was on iRobot, and I was arguing with one of your compers. You were the lead, and I was arguing with the compers that they didn't do something right, and their comper was upset at me because I was like, no, I did it right. I did it right. It's standard argument. Compers and lighters have had mixed relationships over the years. And I was arguing with the comper, and I was like, oh, and then I went back and I was like, damn it. He was right. And it was wrong. And so I sent a very apologetic email, and I copied you on it.
I remember.
And then you sent me an email back. It's like, you know, thanks for being such a big person about it,
and
being
big,
and for really, you know, making sure that you knew that you were wrong, that you apologized for that. And it says it was really nice. And I remember saying, it's like, you know, it's important now. It's not. I'd rather apologize than try to have some pride about a stupid shot, you know?
Pride in being wrong is about the dumbest thing you can do as far as bolstering your credibility.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing you can do to ruin your credibility more than being proudly wrong.
Your response to me made me realize, like, oh, I'm almost glad I messed up, because now you have more respect for me for actually owning up to it.
Well, yeah, and you learn something from it, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, anyone who's never made a mistake I can't even imagine that. I mean, anyone who would have the nerve to even think that.
Imagine. Yeah. And that's why I don't like version ones that look great, you know? I was like, I'm not going to show it until it's perfect. It's like, no, just let
us. Come on. In this economic climate, I love version ones that look great. Well, let's use it on version 101 that's still not looking so great.
Yeah. Speaking of version numbers, iRobot.
HQ 5000. It still comes up. I've worked with Nash now for many, many years. I love any chance. Anyone listening to this, if you ever get the chance to work with Eric Nash, you've got to take it. He's one of the best in the business. He's so much fun.
He is a very funny person.
He's super dry, really dry. You know,
he looks like a drill sergeant a little bit.
He does look like a drill sergeant, but he is one of the coolest dudes and knows so much. And you'll have a great time working with him. But he, to this day, in fact, we just did Night at the Museum 3 together.
Yep.
And you'd get these client calls, and working with a crew that hadn't had, you know, 15 years of knowing him. And he'll be on the phone like, got HQ 5000 in that review today, Lou. And I'm like, oh, I was trying to shoot it and it crashed beforehand. I got a couple more tweaks to make. Got to see that soon, you know. Like, still, 15 years later. How many years later is that now?
It's been a while.
It's like 12 years later. Yeah. It's still coming up, that one shot.
So the story is basically Lou and I have been working on this one shot, HQ 5000. To know what that shot is, if you've ever seen iRobot, it's the shot where it's in a police station and it's like, something's going on outside. And then the doors crash open and all these robots come in and beat up all the cops.
And Sonny jumps in and it's lands right in front of the camera.
It's not Sonny.
No, it's another guy. Comes in, lands right in front of the camera, and he's looking around back and forth, and the camera's right on his face. And you get in the background all this melee going on, all this insanity. There's feels like hundreds of robots.
It was a complicated show. At the time, you got to remember, we only had like 2 gigs of RAM. It was hard to do that shot.
That was the centerpiece of that whole sequence.
Yeah.
It was
a hard shot, and we went through – I want to say probably 100 versions, or maybe. We felt a lot of versions, and a lot of time was spent on it.
And you and I were the worst at that too, because like Eric wants to see it, and you know the producer's like, "Where is it? Where is it?" Like, oh, we're almost in. We kept wanting to make it better. I think we can make this better. And Chris would be over at my desk. I was looking at your comp, and I saw this and this, and I'm like, "Oh God, we got to pull it from dailies." You know, it's not good enough.
Right.
We were each other's worst nightmare on it. You know, like, can you get me a mask for this? Can you get me?
And there was a little bit. Oh, I need. Okay, thanks, Chris. Just one mat. Just for the left arm. Just the left arm. Just the left arm. And so. We would do that, and we're running back and forth.
And Eric's wondering, where's his shot?
And so finally, it was Kelly Lestrange, I think. She was a producer on it, right? Mm-hmm. And so she was finally, because it goes through so many versions, the dollar value of this shot just goes up and up and up and up.
Yeah, we're billing other shots, trying to hide our tracks, you know, staying at night for free.
Just whatever you could take. And finally, it finals. And then became the joke, because we were laughing about how long it took to do that shot. And then Eric... But it was basically at Kelly's expense, but it was between you, me, and Eric. It's like, Did you get that new version of HQ 5000? She's like, what are you talking about?
Like,
it's
her
just
head
that,
would pop up over the wall.
What are you talking about? That shot's final.
That shot's goes, final.
I was like, no. It's just a tech fix. We just, there's one thing we noticed. We just got to fix it real quick. And she was just like, oh, you got it. And we did it for the rest of the show. It's like just
and
kept,
the next show.
And the next show.
And the most recent show.
The most recent show. Yeah. So 15 years later.
And she caught on pretty quick, and she would throw her own little firebombs in there too. Like, oh, yeah. You know, is HQ 5000 coming? I heard that the client kicked it back for whatever. And we'd all look at each other, and she'd, it was funny. We had a good time with that shot.
Yeah, it was a good one.
Shot that kept on giving.
All right. Well, let's talk about X-Men, dude.
All right. What do you want to know?
So, how long were you on the show?
Jeez. It was August, I think I got on it, and we delivered it in May. So
right.
So it was like 5 years compressed into that amount of time.
Is it? Yeah,
it was. I honestly, that is probably the. I mean,
that was quick.
Yeah, and we didn't even really get plates until January. So,
right.
Was, I mean, that is probably the hardest I've ever worked in my life. I got bronchitis twice. I was up. You know, it's a rough show when you're sitting in the screening room at 2:30 in the morning on a Saturday night, and you're sending someone back to their desk for the fourth time that day to make a change on something. And it's the second week in a row you've been there at 2:30 in the morning. But you know it's an awesome show when you tell that comper, you say, look, you know, it's 2:30. The clients have gone home. This could be our first final tomorrow. Why don't you go back and just do it in the morning? It'll be our first final tomorrow. And she says, I didn't work my ass off for the last 48 hours to go home without a final. You stay there. I'll be back in 15 minutes.
Wow.
And you just get that like hot tear, like the General Patton tear that just wants to come out the corner of your eye. You suck it back up with sheer testosterone and like, you know, like, my God, I'm so proud. You know? And it just like, that was amazing. It was such an amazing moment. And that gave all of us in that room the strength to get through the end of it. She was like,
who is that?
Catherine Mueller. She was awesome. I mean, so tough. And she shot it back and we finaled it. It was great. You know, it was.
Well, how could you not after that?
I was terrified if I would have kicked it back again. She might have killed me.
Yeah, she would have.
Yeah, she's rad. And but that was kind of the spirit that everybody on that show seemed to have. And
that's
I'm not
wonderful.
Sure what it was. It was a strange kind of collective delirium. I don't know, a collective madness that we all had that it was just – everyone had that attitude and was really trying to make every single part of it the best it could possibly be. And our clients were amazing on that show. I mean, we had so much fun.
Yeah,
with
how
our
was
clients.
It like to work with Brian Singer? Was that your first Brian Singer show?
I'd worked with Brian before. In fact, on X-Men, I didn't really get any Brian time. It was all directly with Richard Stammers, the studio side VFX.
Gotcha.
And
yep.
He was awesome to work with.
Wonderful.
I mean, just knew exactly what battles to pick, how hard to fight them, where to focus the resources, where to focus the time. You know, uncompromising eye. I felt like every pixel in that we delivered, I was proud of. I didn't, you know, you always end up on every show, there's something that happens where you look at it and you're like, God, I wish I could go back and do this, or I wish I could go back and do that. Honestly, I got to say on X-Men, I feel like I don't know that I would change anything. I mean, I know there's that cliche of, oh, you're never done with a shot. You can always make it better. And I don't know. I'm pretty happy with what we did. I feel like, you know, I would have liked to have more time to get there so I didn't get bronchitis twice on that show.
Right.
But I mean, that was partly my own doing because I just wanted it to be awesome. And, you know, we all wanted it to be awesome. And, you know, Catherine wanted it to be awesome.
Right.
And, you know, she's sending herself back to her desk to make notes, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, that's where do you get that kind of spirit in people? And they really, everybody brought that, you know, to that show. So it was like a really great vibe of professionals all trying to, and it wasn't competitive either. It was like everyone trying to outdo themselves. Like, I know I can do this better. Pushing
right.
themselves, you know, like, this isn't ready to look at yet. Like, well, we need to send a temp. No. They might final it. Like, well, wouldn't that be great? No, because I, you know.
It's not final to me.
It's not. Exactly. And you really had to. And when you're fighting that in people as opposed to fighting like, you know, oh, come on, I'm done with the shot already.
Yeah.
You know.
That happens too sometimes.
It does. It definitely does. But it was such a fantastic vibe. I mean.
Those are the best shows. You know, when things run smoothly. They're it just brings up a certain level of pride and people. And I think that's I knew the first time I experienced that actually was probably, I mean, of course, my first show was A Day After Tomorrow. So that had some history to it. Not necessarily the smoothest running show, and there's lots of history behind that. But it's fun.
That's for another podcast.
Oh, I love that. We've actually talked about it on the podcast before.
I'm sure.
But
statute of limitations run out. Or?
But iRobot was one of the first really smooth running shows.
We were terrified at first with the shot count. I mean,
I remember, and the thing that happened on that show, we didn't have any finals for the longest time. People were worried that we were never going to be able to finish.
Yeah.
And what happened, all of a sudden, it just escalated to the point of we were finaling things so fast and going through it so fast that everyone had a sense of pride. It's like, this is going so well. It took us a while to get there, but we knew we made the right decisions. To the point that by the end of the show, a lot of the lighters were kind of like, didn't have much to do. They were just sort of maintaining a few things here and there where they were all doing weird, their own little gag shots left and right.
Yeah,
just
the gag shots were great on that.
We had a lot of great gag shots. And we were basically maintaining whatever you need to do for comp to get short finals, we're going to get done. And then just, you know, keeping ourselves occupied and having a lot of camaraderie doing weird gag shots.
Yeah, rendering elements for shot builds and stuff like that. I remember, I mean, to your point, the first robot shot I ever did on that was HQ 5010. It was the shot where the robot jumps on the cop and snaps his neck and then looks up, and it was for a trailer. In fact, that shot final and for the trailer the night that I found out my wife was pregnant with my first child.
Wow.
I totally remember that.
And that's why you remember that number.
That's why. Well, yeah. and I remember I had a hack. I had a bust open Makebot and add nodes and pull stuff out and change everything and totally changing stuff, you know, and like it really took me a while to dial the robot in, you know, gamma-ing up the Fresnel and like, don't tell anybody.
Don't tell me.
Doing all this different stuff to try to make it look good to get it out in time. And then the last shot I did on iRobot was VL7390. Ryan Vance lit it, and it was the shot where the wire whips by and cuts those robots in half in slow motion. And all I did was I lifted the blacks a pinch and added grain. And so through the course of that first shot to that last shot, it just kept getting – the lighters would zero in. Oh, the compers are having to do this every time. The mutton chops kept showing up. So now let's fix that. And so the back and forth of getting the perfect element, quote unquote, evolved over the course of the show.
Right.
And at the end, we achieved it. It was great. That's exactly the way it's supposed to work, you know, I think anyway.
And did you feel some of that? Did you feel some of that as well on X-Men? Or did you feel that it was – I mean, those are very different things you were doing on X-Men, right?
It was harder to do that on X-Men because a lot of the work was effects based. You know, there's a lot of simulations,
the sims and stuff that were going for the stadium, right?
Exactly.
Was the stadium your biggest sequence on that?
I think so. I mean, we had the Mystique transformations, which were awesome, and those were a lot of fun. Very difficult, especially in stereo. I mean, brutal. And then the stadium liftoff, flyover, and drop, and the Sentinels, the 73 Sentinels, which I always think sounds like a hockey team or something.
Yeah,
you know? 1973 Sentinels, and they come skating out on the. There's even that shot where they all fly up in formation while Magneto's flying. And I always laugh. It just feels like the hockey players skating out.
It feels like something from Smokey and the Bandit.
it feels really funny. Like it's a sports team or something. But they
were designed like they looked like they were. They looked like they were designed in 1973. That's the point we were
shooting for. Like future retro. Futurism, you know, and even that I don't know if you've seen it. Obviously, the robot vision where they look out, and they see. I did those shots myself based on some art concepts that Nick Lloyd did. Nick Lloyd did a bunch of still kind of concepts of things, and then, you know, I like this from here and this from here and this from here. But in the end, I went and built it all, made it a shot, you know, that could move and use the footage in there and everything. And I actually used my Atari 800 emulator to figure out what the fonts should look like and how fast it would draw the text and everything.
Nice.
And so I timed it all around my Atari 800 emulator. It's total nerd town here.
Right.
This is big time Nerdville.
That's all right. That's most of our audience.
Yeah. I opened that up and I saw how fast it could draw the text and what the flicker looked like and the hum of a CRT. And I just copied it all. I mean, I was doing this stuff in the middle of the night because you finish your work as a VFX EP, you finish your work when the last person goes home, and nobody went home on that show. Everyone was like, you know, no, I'm going to stay a little longer. I just want to finish the shot. Like, dude, you're done. I mean, you got to go home. This is it. We need you strong tomorrow. Don't worry. I'll go home soon. And so I was waiting until everyone would leave, and so I would stay and I'd work on these shots in the meantime, and came up with that whole like retro design based on actual 70s technology,
right?
Which so the whole thing was designed to try to look like it took place in and from the 70s.
Wow. Well, it looked awesome, and I think and then the stadium is just incredible.
Thank you.
And it was funny because we're talking about it. And we're looking at the behind the making of stuff that you guys put out there, and we have a new guy that we hired at work. His name is Sean, and he's part of our marketing team. So he comes from a marketing background, but he doesn't know much about VFX at all. So he's learning this stuff, and we're saying, yeah, this is an example of X-Men. He's looking at the stadium. He's like, wait a minute, that's all CG? It's like, well, what did you expect? They didn't lift us. No, there's no stadium back there. What are they doing to it?
I get that a lot.
Yeah, and it's like, of course it is. But the point is that they didn't, it looked so good that they didn't even realize it.
Thank you. It's a lot of amazing people spent a lot of time making it look that way.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to get to ride their coattails to glory. But a lot of people, when I get that, what I get a lot is like, well, I thought that at least before it was destroyed that you guys shot it in a real stadium and then you guys just took over with CG at some point and broke the CG parts of it.
But I had to explain that it's really hard to book a stadium for 4 days straight to shoot in it or whatever you need to do.
Yeah. And even if you could, I mean, you'd end up replacing it because you're going to have that frame where it goes from the stadium to the destroyed one or whatever.
It's easier to make it all CG at that point as long as it looks real.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because trying to match the real one probably and get it pixel perfect with this every seat, you're just not going to be able to do that. I mean,
right.
You have to do it as projections, and then you're, I don't know, just that almost sounds scarier. But it was like a 200 by 200 green box with a white silk roof and Magneto on a crane. And
how did you guys do all the, did you guys get plates of DC or did you have to do?
We did get some plates of DC for the aerials, you mean, when you're in the air looking down and stuff. We did get some DC plates, and they were great.
How did that happen? Because it was an interesting thing. We had a conversation with the guys at ILM, because ILM was also one of our clients, and they were dealing with stuff on Captain America, and they weren't allowed to get anywhere near shooting anything. So they had to make CG DC in a background because of the aerial restriction problem. So I'm curious how much you actually had and how much you had to change and add.
Well, you have to get rid of any non-period correct architecture in there.
Right.
Buildings that look modern that you had to get rid of all of them and add smog, I guess. But the thing about shooting in Washington, D.C. is you can shoot from some angles and not others. There are some approaches to the White House that your flight path cannot take.
Okay.
And then there are others that you can if you get it cleared. And we were really lucky that a lot of the footage that we got was pretty good. Long lenses, so you could – so, you look like you're closer than you were for some of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Matt Sloan – I want to say it was Matt Sloan that shot most of that stuff. And he is amazing. He was a second unit VFX on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that dude, he's got ideas just pop up out of the sky that you're like, oh my god, how are we gonna, and he's already got a solution for it. He's like Radar O'Reilly with an Australian accent. He's
right,
just
nice.
He's already working on the thing that he's going to use to film it, and it's always something simple too. You're like, oh my god, duct tape and a broom handle, that's a great idea.
Yep.
he's really inventive, and he's always like thinking one or two steps ahead of where he needs to be. And so that was I think he's responsible for most of that footage. Most of that was shot before I got on the show, frankly. I mean, I just heard the stories afterwards about how, the Secret Service had to look through all the footage and they would edit out stuff right off of the camera.
Like, oh, sorry, right.
Yeah, this, you can't have this, can't have this, can't have this, but this you can have and this you can have. But that's the best thing. Like, can you tell me what it is that I'm not supposed to see?
Nope.
It's classified. Yeah. Okay.
Well, then then they'd know.
Then you'd know. Then we'll have to kill you. But
right.
It is obviously very difficult, and it's not like you can go shoot on the White House lawn either, right?
No.
So we had to build the whole CG White House and the trees and everything. And we actually got on the phone with the White House historian. And the nice thing about historians is, I mean, I like to talk. You know that. You like to talk. I mean, we both love the sound of our own voices. But these historians are the bomb. They love to talk. And this guy told us everything. What trees were there during the Nixon administration, how big they would have been, where they would have been, and all this. And we started with that. We used SpeedTree to populate the lawn with what would have been there at the time. And that's your starting point. historical authenticity. And then from there, you have to make some decisions like, okay, those magnolias, we needed to do this with them or do that with them, or maybe make them a little bigger, that change some stuff around for aesthetic reasons. But you start with that idea of historical accuracy so that anyone watching that would know, you know, that
That's correct.
And and there's plenty of period photography that you can look at, as Nixon walking around with Saudi Arabian king and whatever. It's
right.
Like strange to look at it all, to go through it all. And, you know, the Carters out there.
And, yeah, but it's funny that you look through that footage and suddenly you're not looking at Nixon. It's like, oh, there it is. That's the tree I was looking for.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, but it's really an interesting journey to go through and look at all that historical reference and look at all those pictures, because you get kind of caught up in your mind about what was happening at the time and what like that president had no idea what was about to happen in the world or what was about to happen to them. And I get caught up in all that kind of stuff and like trees. Oh yeah. Trees. And back to the trees.
Looking at this, he doesn't know about Watergate yet.
He doesn't know that they know about Watergate yet. You know, like, but it is, it happens. And when you look at it and you're just like, wow, it's amazing. And so it was that added a fun dimension to the whole thing too.
Yeah. Yeah. I bet. So like you said, it was not, you didn't have place for a long time and you guys had to develop a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. What are some of the more, what's some of the most memorable parts of it? What do you remember the most about the
The whole tree journey was brutal. I mean, that was
really,
my God, because we didn't really have a foliage pipeline, to be honest, at the time. That was robust and as effective as
a full what pipeline?
Foliage.
Oh, like foliage.
Trees and shrubberies?
Shrubberies,
that,
right?
That sort of thing. So in putting that together, came up with all these different species of trees. And Kristen McLean, our environments lead on the show, she was just never say die, never crack, never, just the ultimate stoic superhero. She was just like, okay, I'll go back and try this. I'll go back and try that. And we had to have trees that could, you could throw a breeze through it, and it had to be gentle, medium, and severe, you know, for when the robots were flying over, their turbulence would make the trees move.
Right.
And you had to be able to target it, and you had to be able to do this, and we had to be able to render the damn thing. And, you know, and that was a pretty, a daunting task. And Richard Stammers, our client side VFX suit, being that he's from England, he, you know, I'm from California. I know what a palm tree looks like. I know what some dead grass looks like, but he's from England, so he knows a tree.
Right,
I mean,
right,
nobody
right.
knows a tree like an English guy. So he's looking at this, like, you know, he saw things in there that, that I hadn't thought of or hadn't noticed. And I mean, that's why he was who he was and I was who I was. And, but he really like challenged us on that, making that look great, which was great because it really upped it. And to the point where he finally was happy with it. And when he showed Brian Singer, I don't think Brian realized, I asked Richard afterwards, I was like, so how'd Brian react to the trees? And I forgot to mention that those were CG trees. And to be honest with you, I don't think that he noticed. And I was like, we did it. We did it. We're there. We're there, you know.
I love those moments.
Oh, man. It was so
great.
When
they're like, you know, those moments when they don't even realize that what they're seeing is CG, they forget about it, you know.
Yeah.
It's just basically like the stadium. Like, of course it's CG, but the person didn't even realize it.
Yeah. Well,
it's so good. You don't even remember it.
It's not making a meal out of itself to pull you out of. That's another thing. The CG a lot of times, like, oh, I'm going to stay self-illuminated and make sure that every pixel is visible. Like, no, sometimes you need to just blend into the background.
Right.
Part of your job is to not be seen, just to be a little suggestion of something.
Yep.
You know, we went to Richard took a few of us out to Vegas after the show was over. We went on a little. R&R out there, and we're swimming at the pool and everything. And I was like, I'm gonna go sit in the hot tub for a little bit. And I was sitting in the hot tub and relaxing, you know, a little drink and leaning back. And I lay back and I smell nice, fragrant, you know, flowers in the air. And I lay back and I look up, and above me is a giant magnolia tree. And I was like, get me out of this hot tub. And Joe ran out of the hot tub. He's like, what happened? I thought you were going in the hot tub. I was like, there's a magnolia tree over there. He's like, oh, would you stop it?
I've seen too many. That's like seeing a big hawk flying over you.
Oh, God. It was just like, it's too soon for me to see magnolia trees.
Yeah.
I could smell the flowers. I'm like, where is that? I know there's a magnolia tree around here. Like, getting like, you know, post-traumatic stress.
It's funny that
stress.
You're like, you know, this is something that pop-up people wouldn't even realize. Like, oh,
wouldn't
even realize that this caused as much stress as it did, is to make sure.
I mean, it was great that we got it where it is, but for a while there, especially in Vegas, I was suffering, you know, post-traumatic stress.
Post-traumatic stress. Nice.
See what I did there?
Good. All right. Well, let's see what besides the trees, was there anything else that we thought was pretty interesting or challenging?
Well, I mean, honestly, the whole thing was we had a bit with the Sentinels, the 73 Sentinels,
yep.
where for the longest time we hadn't shown them anything, you know, and they weren't bugging us for it, you know, but I was getting a little antsy. I wanted to start seeing stuff. And Tim Nassau was our lighting guy. Yeah. You know, Tim, he's like, you got to pull it out of his hands. And
oh, yeah.
And you have to stare at it for half an hour before
Tim will be the guy. I don't know if people – like, he's the guy who's sitting at the – he's there early and leaves late. And he's like, I'm just not ready yet. I just got to get it perfect.
And you got to pull it out of his hands. And then you got to look at it for 45 minutes before he finally tells you what's bugging him about it. And you still can't see it. You know, like, right. He's amazing. And, you know, but we got these Sentinels. And he'd gone through himself and, like, cleaned up the reference photography,
yep,
and then rendered the robot and comped the robot and stuck it in there and, you know, and shot it to our daily setup, and, you know, and we're looking at it, and I was like, all right, so what's up with, why is the lighting reference in here? And Tim's just sitting there with this big smile on his face, nodding. And I was like, that's not lighting reference, is it? I think the paint job's a little sloppy. And he's like, dude, come on, give me a break. You know, I did that at like 3 a.m. I just wanted to get it as clean as I could to put the robot in there. And that's when I realized, like, oh my God, we're not looking at lighting reference. We're looking at his render, his latest batch of renders.
Right.
And he was sitting there really proud and, you know, annoyed that I was picking on his paint, plate clean. And so we sent those straight over to Richard, and Richard calls up and he says,
and just so for people know, we're not talking about like average Joe looking at this and saying, I don't realize it's CG. We're talking about you looking at it.
Oh, well, kind.
But we're looking at someone with a lot of experience, knowing that it's fooled you. And that's a big deal.
Well, and then it gets over to Richard and he calls me up and he goes, well, I at first I was wondering, you know, why are they sending on lighting reference back to us?
Right.
And he's like, why did they send our lighting reference back to us? And I realized, oh, wait a minute, that's a bit of a shoddy job on the paint cleanup. So he realized that it was CG, you know, CG. And so he showed Brian, and Brian says, okay, great. So now I know what the reference looks like. What it's really. Mm-hmm. So it got through all three.
It fooled
Matt as well, right. Over there. So it fooled, you know, three VFX soups, yep, and a director. And Tim was so happy that night. He actually, I knew he was happy because he left at like 8. So he's like, yeah, I think I can go home early tonight.
You know? Yeah. Yep.
Went home at like 8, you know.
Yeah, I remember those specific notes on iRobot, not iRobot, on Real Steel, when we had a practical robot and a real one, and then the director would look at it and said, well, can you change the lighting a little bit like this? It's like, actually, that's a real robot. And he goes, I can't even tell anymore. He was just getting upset. So those are the kind of comments that are also really great.
That's great. I mean, that's how you know you're over the hump. And at that point, you know, it's all down to the aesthetic choices and artistic choices on what they want to do with something. And it feels so good when you do that, you know, when you can fool yourself, you know, like, I got to do a double take myself on some of it sometimes.
Nothing feels better than just nailing it.
Nailing it.
Yeah.
And you don't always do that, but when you do it, you got to hold on to it for the times when you get beaten up.
And I think it always feels better when you nail it after you've failed for several times too, because you've made the right mistakes. And usually what happens to me is like, I mess up, it looks wrong. I take a little tweak, it looks wrong, like a little tweak, looks wrong. And I do this several times, and then I have to, it's like, all right, you know what? Hold on a second. What have I learned through all this? Scrap the whole thing, start again from scratch, and then it just happens that way.
Yeah. Sometimes that's what you got to do. You know?
Yeah. And you got to make that choice, right?
Yeah. I don't remember a time that we had to do that on X-Men, actually. Now that you mention that, it's funny because I know those times. I can think of, I'm going through them now. They're like rifling cards in a deck in my head here.
Right.
But all right, it wasn't that many. But they're on X-Men, everything did feel like a progressive march toward the finish line. I mean, we didn't have time to not have it be that,
right,
you know. And the simulations, the RBDs all came together, and, you know, the effects team, Jeremy Hampton and Daniel Stern and Hiroshi, you know, they just – everyone was kind of in their own track, but it was all happening at the same time and all kind of came up together. And, you know, the smoke in that stadium, I was really adamant about the way that should look. You know, I don't want to have it all be the same color. So many times you're watching a movie or you're watching something and you're just like, all that smoke is the same color.
Yep.
That is just a dead giveaway, because that smoke is made up of, you know, it's concrete and it's rusty metal and it's you know, different kinds of concrete, and there's some asphalt maybe in there, yep. and maybe there's some plastic in there, and there's all kinds of different materials that are going into brick, even that are going into making up the stadium. And so everyone, and then there's the dirt from the ground, which, so there needs to be a little brown hanging low, mm-hmm. a little gray on the sides, bluish gray here, you know, different shades of gray for different materials that, mm-hmm. and that lends a sense of realism and scale to the thing. It's like, if it's all
and
the same
depth
color,
too.
Yeah, totally. Because if it's all the same color, it just looks like it's small, and it's all that dust is all one kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But when it has that kind of color and textural complexity, it looks huge because, like, oh wow, you can really see the tonal variety in that dust. And that was something I drove the guys crazy with that. I thought they were gonna like lynch me or something. And at one point, but in the end, I think, you know, running all the different passes so that the mask passes and everything, so compers could kind of very subtly dial in color tricks, because you don't want to do that in the element. You're not going to, because then if you want to make a subtle tweak, you're going to render out that again. I mean, we don't have all the procs in the world, you know.
Right.
I think you got to be practical about it. And so doing the masks was great, because then you can color tint the smoke a little bit here, a little bit there. Mm-hmm. And I felt like it worked. I was really happy with the way that turned out.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
So that was another one for you, of a challenge I remember fighting through.
I like it. It's a great story, and I think it's an important one to remember when people are doing debris and doing destruction, is to have that, think about what, don't just add a bunch of smoke. You got to have to think about what that smoke's coming from and what's it about, and it does all those things.
Some of it's thicker, some of it's thinner, some, yep. you know, and that complexity is all there. The comper that did that shot was, I mean, Kieran O'Connor, he just owned it. I mean, he was in there just manhandling that, those elements, just getting them in place and dialing them in and just marching until he was happy with it. He was another one. He was kind of like a Tim. I'm like, I'm happy with the show. No, I want to do a couple more tweaks to it. I want to do a couple more tweaks to it. And like, you know, you can't kill the guy's spirit. You got to go for it, dude. We'll send them a really good looking temp.
Yep. Yep.
You know, and really, really rocked it.
And this was your second show as a VFX supervisor, wasn't it?
It was my first
full-on show.
Full, properly credited. Yeah, I'd done a little dabbling here and there on a few other ones.
Right.
In the kind of more behind-the-scenes kind of
Yeah, but stuff. This was the first one where you were in as the VFX supervisor starting from DD. And
credited, titled, yeah, hired
and
as.
So that's and pretty that, awesome considering you got nominated on your first show. I know you try to pretend like you're not humble, but you are, and I know you, but
No, I mean, I you know, this is one of those things where it's like I feel like a little almost embarrassed, because there's no way any one or four people did that. You know, I mean, like,
of course not.
It's I was so lucky.
I don't think anyone's going to say that.
Yeah, with the team that we, I mean, that whole team deserved to be there.
Yeah, and you're not the comper or anything else, but you provided a sense of leadership to make that happen. I always say that myself. Whenever I'm working with people, I always want to hire the best people possible, because those are the people that are going to make me look really good.
Yeah.
So, and
most of them were hired before I got on the show, to be honest. I mean, I kind of came on a little bit late.
But you were able to give them the right motivation and right thing, because that makes a huge difference. And you gave him the right eye, I'm sure. You were able to, you know, to that, what's her name, the comper?
Catherine.
Catherine. Mm-hmm. She would never have done that if she didn't believe in you, right?
Well, thanks for saying so. I mean, you'd probably have to ask somebody
I'm
else
sure,
that.
But, well, and she was proud of it. She was like, I'll do it. I'll do it. If she didn't like you, she was like, screw it. All right, I won't do it.
I don't know. I don't think, maybe not.
But I think there's some motivation.
Serious
there.
Professional who takes pride in her work.
Yeah.
You know,
but I think it's good. And I think it was great. And I'm sure that everyone's very happy that you were bummed. Because, first of all, I was very happy. You know how excited I was. I texted you like first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, congratulations.
Yeah,
woke up and I saw the news and I was like, bah.
It was surreal. I mean, I honestly, because there was at the Bake Off, there was so much good work in the Bake Off. I was like, wow, you know, I don't know.
It was a stellar year.
It was too soon, man. it was brutal. It was a brutal year. All the work was so good, you know, and very different kinds of work too,
right?
Something that I was really impressed by. I was like, wow, it's terrifying how good, how many people can do such good work, you know, and it's all pretty crazy. But the reception that we got from our reel, in particular the Quicksilver sequence, when that Quicksilver sequence played, we were sitting there in the crowd and the reel played, Richard had done the intro, and then the reel played and the Quicksilver bit, they had the whole little 30 shot chunk in the reel.
Yeah.
At the end of that, the place went crazy. And I've been going to Bake Offs now for, you know, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've ever seen that kind of reaction from a crowd before. Everyone was cheering and clapping, so much so that Bill Taylor at the end of it, he said, you know, oh, you got to hold your applause till the end of the reel, just out of fairness to all the, and I'm thinking, I'm glad, no way, man, let it go when you feel it, you know? Yeah. And it was, I, at that moment I thought, wow, we're probably going to make it through, you know, because
you didn't think he was going to make it through, did you?
Well, I didn't want to be presumptuous, and I always try to, you know, I don't want to get my hopes up and everything.
Let's make it fair. There was a lot of great work, and I think that X-Men was a little bit of an underdog in that situation, but I think that X-Men was very, very interesting, and the reason it got nominated is because there was some really incredible work in there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the body of work, I felt like the thing is that I really, like I said, I'm really proud of every shot that we did. I'm really proud of every pixel that every person put into that. And NPC's work was fantastic as well. Sure. All the Future Sentinel stuff and, you know, the attack on the old age home, as I called it, that sequence. And then of course, Rising Sun with the Quicksilver stuff, that was just amazing. And like, that's such a great use of visual effects, because that stuff wasn't even that, I don't think that they had to develop too many new tools or get crazy with anything. It was the idea of using the tools you have to tell the story, and that story was good as it was.
Yeah.
And then the tools were, they and just it was, used the tools it was to telling, tell that story.
And it was, what was cool is, like, obviously it's a VFX shot. It has to be, but it was funny. It was beautiful. It told a story. It put you in the exact moment that you're trying to do something. And I think it's,
everything was right. The music, the attitude, the costumes, every bit of it.
I had
it
a
was
smile
right.
on my face. Me you know, too. The whole time.
I still, every time I see it, you can't look away. It's so good. And I mean, but I feel like that sequence was very eye catching and very memorable. But if that was the only good stuff and the rest of it, we did, you know, our stadium sucked and Mystique sucked and everything else.
No,
we never made it through. So that the solid body of work with a little really sweet cherry on top that put it over the edge. That's kind
of probably,
what I,
you know,
happened.
Most of the people who saw the reels at the Bake Off, because you can't actually at the Bake Off, just most people know, you can't actually show any making of.
No how to's.
Right. So
you can't put audio in there or voiceover or anything. Yep. In this shot, like that.
Right.
It is in the film.
So you have to show it as it is in the film completely, all the exact sound. And for those who don't know what a bake-off is, basically it's the last moment before you go to get nominated. So it's 10 films usually.
10 films, yeah.
And then they narrow it down to 5, and those 5 are the nominations for the Oscars. And then the rest of the Academy then votes on who actually wins.
Right.
So when you show that, as an example, you just talked about how much pain of the trees was. I bet you no one in the Bake Off knew that those trees were CG. Unless
probably,
it was mentioned.
Yeah. Probably.
So again, you know, those are the things.
Maybe.
You know, those are the things, that example that I remember a little bit frustrated me, like when we worked we didn't do it very long, but we were working on Girl with a Dragon Tattoo and we're doing the whole motorcycle sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh yeah. It's like, so you just replaced the head. She had a helmet on, we replaced the head. It's like, well, actually we built the entire environment too, because we couldn't get a helicopter in there. So everything was CG in several shots. And it's like, what? They didn't even realize it. And it's like, well, there you go. That's the whole point. You know, you don't even, it's, you are focused on the event that's happening, which is the chase sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. It's not about showing you a big explosion or doing this and that, but it's about seeing the event that's happening and really just like Magneto lifted that thing up for a reason. It's going to be an oh shit moment, right?
So, and drop it for a reason.
Yeah. You know? So it makes sense.
Pulling the bunker through the front of the White House. That was a terrifying shot. I mean, that's the one thing where Richard was sweating a little bit, and rightly so. I mean, if I was in his shoes, I would have been panicking, but he didn't really get too many chances to see that shot because it was so complicated and it was just such a big beast. And in the 11th hour, Matt Sloan had a great idea about the lanterns. He said, oh, you know, have the lanterns, you know, they're wiggling and wobbling and everything. And then as Magneto changes the field to pull the bunker toward him, they should pop straight out and point right at you. I'm like, that's a great idea. That would have been awesome a few weeks ago, you know.
Right.
But it was such a good idea. Like, yeah, we can't not do that now, because it's going to be a temporary pain to get it in there, but a lifetime of regret if we don't. You know, I kind of have this sick mind where...
Yeah, because you'll look at the shot, it's like, oh, he seals like...
Yeah, I mean, like you go through that temporary pain and then you get to live with the fact that it's right. You know, there's one shot I always think of whenever I get in this mindset. There's one shot I was on, it was on Pirates of the Caribbean 3 when Lord Beckett's walking down
the staircase
and yep. It's all blowing up around him in slow motion. And there's two frames of one of those panels, because that wood was all balsa wood with veneers on it, right? Mm-hmm. With mahogany veneers. And there's one bit where one of those veneers pops up, and in two frames you can see the double-sided tape that holds that sucker to the banister. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, 11:30 at night, and we'd been going. We had 11 weeks to do all that work. That was so brutal. And we were, you know, the comper was there, it was Kevin Lingenfelser, and we were, you know, we're looking at it, and Brian Grill was VFX at the time, and mm-hmm. I was comp souping, and we're looking at it, and I saw that, and I was like, oh, I could see that tape there, you know, and Brian, like, where, backing up, you know, I kind of see it. And Kevin's like, oh, you want me to go fix it? And I was like, you know, that was the only thing. It passed the gauntlet, you know, the QC was fine, the grain was all fine, the edges, everything was fine. That was the only thing in there. And I thought, you know, you know, and everyone's looking at me like, come on, we shouldn't, it's like, we're so tired. All right. Don't worry about it. Let's just send it off and see what happens. It's still there. And every time I see it in the lobby when I walk through, it bothers me. And I like, right. It would have taken me an hour, even myself, just like, all right, Kevin, go home. I'm going to do it myself. Although he would have been, no, I'm going to do it, you know. And then I put him through the pain. But right. I would have spent that hour of pain, got home an hour later. And then every time I see it, I'd be like, yeah, you know,
yeah.
As opposed to just going, oh, those two frames of that double-sided tape is going to drive me nuts. And it does. It still drives me crazy. And that's a lesson learned, that like that temporary pain is worth going through.
Yeah.
And so that's why I feel like on X-Men, I feel really
happy. Because you're feeling
a
lot of pain every hour. You walk by in the lobby and that shot comes up. You're feeling that pain.
I just stay out of the lobby, man. I go in the back door.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it is, though. It is one of those things where, you know, you have pride in what you're doing and you want it to be as good as it can be. And if you can see it, then you know someone else is going to see it. And so you just want it to be, you know, especially with HD and pause and step forward frame, you know, you want it to be perfect. And so I feel like what's really nice with X-Men is I sleep well at night knowing that we did everything we could to make that awesome. And I feel like we did, you know, I feel really proud of all that.
Yeah. Well, definitely. So what was the Oscars like?
It was, you know, I'm pretty, not a glitzy glamour kind of guy. You know, my idea of the Oscars is, you know, Chinese takeout and a bottle of wine and just sit at home and watch it with the wife and go through the ballot and see, you know, make our best guesses and loser does the dishes. You know, it's kind of, I'm pretty simple when it comes to that.
Right.
And I thought I was just going to be miserable. You know, I thought it was going to be the kind of thing where, you know, oh gosh, you know, this is, I mean, obviously the honor is amazing and mm-hmm. the whole recognition of the team's work is a fantastic component. And the motivation for everybody that worked on, everybody was so excited. And that part of it's all fantastic. It was just the event itself seemed like I'm going to go there and really feel like a nobody. Right. And there is a degree of that, but, you know, like, oh, you got to stand over here because Clint Eastwood's got to come through. And like, well, yeah, sure. I get that. Yep. I totally get that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know, it's not, that certainly makes sense to me, but, I gotta say it was one of the most fun, memorable nights of my whole life. And I highly recommend it to anybody who gets a chance. It's so much fun. I'll lose again, again and again, man. I'd love to lose again.
I don't think, winning puts its own pressure on. So you don't want that.
That was just an amazing night in the governor's ball afterwards. And I mean, it was so much fun. And just to be there with all our friends too, because every single film that was up for something had someone we knew and that we were friends with. And so from it Brian Grill and Dan Lemon.
Yeah, that's right. Dan Lemon.
You know, and Joe and Stefan Ceretti. I mean, there was just great people. So if anyone would have won, and Paul, you know, Franklin, too, the one who did win.
Right.
I mean, you know, Paul, my wife and Paul worked together at NPC 20 years ago. They've been friends forever. I've known Paul. I mean, he's a great guy and so happy for them, you know. And so if anyone would have won, there couldn't have been a loser, because whoever would have won, you'd been like, sweet, good for you, man. You know, and I met Bruce Dern that night at the governor's ball. He was just sitting there by himself, like macking on some governor's ball treats. And I went over and I was like, you know, I had a couple of loser juice bevies in me and went over there. And I just sat down and started talking to him. And he was so cool. And he knew so much about visual effects because he was, you know, he was in Silent Running and he was telling me about Doug Trumbull stories and Stanley Kubrick stories. And so he talked to me for like 20 minutes. I was like, this guy is so cool. And when I went back and saw Paul with his Oscar, I was like, dude, you want to meet Bruce Dern? He's like, Yeah, let's go. So he grabs his Oscar and we go over and we sat down and we talked to Bruce for another 20 minutes. And I was just thinking, like, this is the coolest guy. And this would have never happened in any other circumstance. How else am I going to get the chance to hear some of the stuff he's got? And he was asking us questions about some of the technology and asking about, you know, the difference between, like, because they shot a lot of miniatures on Interstellar. So he was really interested to hear what Paul had to say about the way they were shooting miniatures. And he was relating his stories about how they shot miniatures back in his day. And
right.
It was so cool. I mean, it was like, here's a guy who, he's a phenomenal actor. He doesn't need to know about visual effects, much less, you know, respect or care about him.
Right.
And he was so, you know, knowledgeable, cool, approachable, you know, had nothing but good stuff to say. It was great. I mean, those kind of experiences were just fantastic. And like I said, you're not going to get that any other time, you know.
Well, you know, here's the thing that made me especially happy about you getting nominated and everything that happened. And it's because in our business, right?
You're going to make me blush, Chris.
No. In our business is the fact that that's kind of – if you work in visual effects and you do something like that, what we do is that's the pinnacle, right? It's like getting nominated for an Oscar somehow seems like if what's your goal and that's going to be like one of the top goals. Mm. Or a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah.
A lot of people feel it's like my goal is that in the next 10 years, I'm going to be a VFX supervisor and I'm going to get nominated for an Oscar. And I've known people who have said that very directly to me. Yeesh. And
that's a red flag to me.
I know it is. And that's a lot of it was, you know, Day After Tomorrow was a lot of that.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So, but
no comment.
But in a sense, I've never, ever felt that from you. That feeling, you're always just like having fun and being enjoying the company of people and working as a team. You're always good at seeing things, working as a team, getting the best out of everyone that we work with. And I think that when I saw that you were nominated, I was like, that's the one who I want to be nominated. That's the one. That's the kind of guy that
you are
like,
going to make me blush.
Yeah, that's the kind of person that I want to go in there and go, hey, because you know what? He is representing everyone. Everyone I know who worked on that show is going to be happy about that person being nominated because you are the representative of your team. I feel that way at least because I've worked with you for quite a few shows.
That's very, very kind. I really appreciate you.
So when
that.
You went there and you experienced that, I was like, I wonder how Lou is going to deal with it. Just like you were mentioned before, it's like, I'm not the kind of person that normally would go to the Oscars. And everything you said made sense. And the fact that you found a way to make it about something else when he's like, oh, here's my great opportunity to hang out with cool people.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of always what you do because that's what you do at work anyway.
Yeah, I had a mission that night to talk to Michael Keaton because he had just won the Golden Globe for Birdman. And, you know, I have two kids and he in his acceptance speech for the Golden Globes, he was talking about how he wanted to talk about his best friend and his best friend is, you know, all these great things, kind and caring and intelligent and funny and hardworking and empathetic and all these fantastic qualities, you know, and he's my best friend is my son. And I'm sitting there watching that at home. And I mean, I'm not too proud to say it. I was really soaking the cheeks when I was watching that.
Oh yeah. Well, I'm a dad thing, too. I know exactly what.
Oh my God. It just choked me right up. And I was thinking about my own son. And the next day I told my son about it and I told him about the speech and the Birdman said this last night. And you know, my son's 7 for the record.
Yeah.
And I told him, you know, he has all these great things to say about his best friend and his best friend's his son. And I think that would be, you know, a good thing for us to shoot for. You know, there'll be times where you're going to be annoyed with me for telling you to brush your teeth or annoyed with me for telling you that you can't go to school in your underwear or whatever it might be. These things happen, folks. Yes. You know, you're going to be and you know, the next 10 years, there's going to be a lot of those kind of conversations. But as long as we're always aiming to be best buds, that's the Birdman promise we're going to make to each other. So we call it the Birdman promise. Like we have the Birdman promise, the Birdie Boys, you know. And I had taken him out a couple of days after that. We went golfing. He loves to go golfing. We took him out, went out for some dinner. And, you know, when I was putting him to bed that night, I read him a story. And he's laying there in bed and he rolls over and he looks at me and he goes, you know, Dad, you know that Birdman thing you were talking about? I go, yeah. He goes, I really felt that today. And I was just like, me too. Gotta go. You know, just, it was amazing. So I wanted to meet Michael Keaton so I could thank him for giving me a very specifically worded, very specific incident that I could point to encapsulate this kind of vague idea that I've always had about how I want to be with my kids as they grow up. And both of them, my daughter too. I mean, I want the same thing. The Birdman promise applies to both kids. And so I got to do that. I got to talk to him and he was in demand. I mean, he was hopping around. Everyone's trying to get a piece of him.
Right.
But he stood there and he let me tell him that. And he was, you know, oh my God, that's so nice to hear that it touched you. And this, it's a fantastic age to get that in there. And, you know,
yeah.
He was really, I could tell he was really happy that he had made an impact like that in someone's life.
I think I want to do that to my daughter when I go home.
Well, yeah. I think actually I'm going to mention that because you know what? You were one of the first people that I came to when my wife was pregnant.
Oh, I remember that. I remember.
I went up to you and I was like, Lou, I want to go out to dinner with you or lunch with you because I needed some advice. I needed some stuff. And your daughter was only like a year or two older. How old is your daughter now?
She's 9 now.
She's 9. Okay. So my daughter's 8, right? So yeah. It was right around that time. And I was like, oh, because I remember you going through the story of, you know, pregnancies and all the craziness. And you were like telling me about like.
It's wild ride.
So, and then you're like, really? Oh boy. Oh boy. And I remember that. And I was going through this stuff and I was like kind of terrified and stuff. But you gave me some really great parenting advice and some really wonderful stuff. And I remember you said some amazing things. But on the other one is
remember, Estrus. My kids are listening to this probably.
Yeah. Estrus told me another wonderful thing. Do you remember Estrus?
Of course. Oh, of course. Estrus.
Estrus.
Barañolo.
Estrus Barañolo. He is the tallest Venezuelan I've ever met. He's a very, very, very big, tall Venezuelan guy. Wonderful, wonderful person. But he said.
Fantastic artist, too.
And fantastic artist. He's at Pixar still. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he told me, he goes, yeah, you know what? Your kids are the most interesting people you will ever meet because they're yours, you know, and they have part of you and they have all these things about you. And you'll never meet. And the way he phrased it, it's like your kids might as well be Gandhi, you know, or whoever it's going to be because they have all these things and you get to see the development and influence it and be all part of it. And they're going to constantly be feeding off of it. And it's, you better take advantage of it, you know, because it just gets more and more interesting.
Yeah. Well, you get another shot at childhood, really. I mean, that's one of the things I found to be fantastic is you get another shot at childhood. I mean, I'm on eBay buying all these ancient toys, like playing with them with my kids, you know, like Mattel is a very safe company that makes very safe toys. That was not always the case.
No, it wasn't.
1960s, they made those thing makers and the strange change machines that heat up.
Karen tried to get a sit and spin. Okay, she tried it. Uh-huh. And the sit and spin from the now are like
lame.
And they try to play songs and stuff. Yeah. They used to be like dangerous things that you would sit on at full speed. Yeah,
exactly. And my son had this. He because I have this great these old school like ovens that cook plastic toys for you. And that's just when you think about that in a modern context, that sounds like insanity. But it was one of the cool, and it's his favorite toy. He loves this thing, and he sees the Mattel logo, and he says, "When I see that, I know it's a great toy, but you got to watch out because it could burn you." And I'm like, that's right. You have to have responsibility and you have to respect the thing that you're playing with.
Yeah.
But I have the best time getting to relive childhood, you know, get all these cool things that, you know, we have an Atari 2600 at home and we have a Wii as well, but the kids would rather play Atari. We'll sit there and play Atari for hours till my wife finally has had enough of the sound effects and it drives her insane. We're like, well, you know, you got a car, you can go out. Like, no, this is going off now. Like, okay, fair enough. You're right. And, but boy, we have so much fun playing those games. I mean, there's so much fun. And those things are, almost 40 years old?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's also the thing is getting to experience them watching old movies again, right? Or movies you've seen.
You know? We watched 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. They went crazy. They're like, this is amazing. You know, my son was walking around talking like James Mason for the next day.
I made my kids, you know, I go to Netflix and basically you can still see some, you know, there's some 80s style kids movies, right? Or 80s kids movies that are out, right? So like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids is on Netflix as an example.
Oh, yeah.
And I get they're so used to seeing the latest thing that's coming out. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, with all the miniatures and weird stuff that was going on there, which is very hokey and stuff, but it was fun. And they loved it. And they enjoyed it. Jumanji, they watched that. And I kind of got excited about that. So I really love that excitement they get about those things. The other thing I think is interesting is, you know, when your kid, you know, your kids are going through school is – learning what they're learning and seeing how, first of all, having to learn math again is like, oh, this, then you realize like, you know, these problems were always so poorly worded and they still are. It's like taking me, I have to read it 4 times to figure out what this damn math question is, you know?
So I love it because I always sucked at math. So it's another chance for me to brush up on it and learn it. Second chance to learn
it. Second chance to learn it is always a good thing.
That's great. I'll take it. You know, I'll take a second chance to learn anything.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up because, we're about an hour and 15. But
beautiful. That was fun.
Yeah.
That was great.
Is this your first podcast you've been on?
First one ever.
All right. Well,
How'd it feel?
Great, great. I'll let you know after you've edited out the parts and I hear the final. We'll see. I'll let you know then.
I was telling Tiffany that we don't actually edit.
Ah, it's going to be just straight, huh? Well, she didn't tell me that.
Yeah,
no, that's good.
I find a good starting point, and then I usually just play, and it plays. You'll be surprised how well it plays.
I can't wait to hear it. Yeah. Actually, I probably will. I'll cringe. I won't listen to it. I can't wait to see emails of people who've heard it.
And, yeah,
it's dude, great. You sounded like a jackass.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're gonna let the last bucket drop. You know that's the saying on the, the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna let the last bucket drop, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris. All right.